Welcome, everybody, to Breaking Kayfabe. I am your host, Jeff Bowdren, with me from the North Pole, because, woo, Barry Rose, it is Merry Christmas time from the good folks here at Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry to all our listeners, because this show will come out on Christmas Day, Barry. So to you and yours, happy holidays, Barry.
Absolutely. Happy holidays from the two best friends you never knew you had. I am Santa Claus. Jeff, you would be, who would you be then? Would you be Chris
Mrs. Claus?
I wasn't going to call you Mrs. Claus. See, I was trying to be nice.
That.
Yeah, exactly. But no, you know what, everybody, it's hard to believe we've done it. Jeff, how many shows are we now?
This is episode 64.
And they said we would never make it. So here we are. It's episode 64. Ratings are as high as they've ever been. I'm certainly as high as I've ever been, Jeff. And I'm really excited. We have a fantastic show today. I am super, super stoked for this one.
Well, we've got some very special things to talk about, Barry. I think you'll agree. We have a special guest interview. And what's great about this one, Barry, is it's somebody that I believe you revealed last week that has never done a podcast before, to my knowledge. Is that correct?
Yeah, so I think years ago there was a podcast out of Calgary, because I actually asked him this. I spoke to him, I think he did something out of Calgary, but we're talking years ago, and I'm not sure. It may have even been a radio show. I don't know if it was even a podcast. He was unsure, so at that stage, if the facts aren't lined up for me, Jeff, we are the first podcast he's ever done.
All right, then. We are talking, of course, about Florida wrestling legend and overall wrestling legend, Bugsy McGraw. Bugsy McGraw has written a book. We are going to be discussing his book. Barry, why don't you tell the folks real quick about the book?
Absolutely. Brute Power, the autobiography of Bugsy McGraw, co-authored with a good friend of ours as well, Ian Douglas. This is a tremendous book. I was lucky enough to get a hold of a copy. Jeff has now read it. And Jeff, I believe you've read the book since we recorded last time. So quickly, give us your thoughts, because God knows I was gushing like a 10-year-old schoolgirl last week.
Yeah, no, I think at the time we did the taping of the interview, I was approximately 2/3 of the way through the book. And as I said, very enthusiastically, one of the things that's great about this book and Bugsy McGraw is Bugsy, I asked him, was there a territory you did not work? And I think he said the AWA might have been the only territory of any note that he didn't work at. You're talking about a guy that went to Japan. He even spent a very small amount of time in Calgary, which is discussed in the book. And that's what's so great is you're going back to the 60s and 70s and into the early 80s, which is right in my wheelhouse, right in Barry's wheelhouse. You're hearing stories about some of the great guys like Lonnie Mane, Joe LeDuc that he had relationships with, Jim Barnett stories from Australia and working under the tutelage of Eddie Graham and Dusty Rhodes. And he tells some great out-of-the-ring stories, including one about Dusty Rhodes that I think most folks will find pretty interesting. He talks about this and so much more. He talks about growing up in small town Indiana and being a huge mark, dare I say, for Dick the Bruiser, and how that's what precipitated him getting into the wrestling business. And it's just a great, great story. And I think something that everyone will like, Barry.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can visit the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry Facebook page with Jeff. How many members now? What are we up to?
I think we're up to about 1,100 at this point, Barry.
Wow. We are growing on a daily basis, but you can visit our page. Again, the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry Facebook group page. You will see a link to a Kickstarter. When Kickstarter is kind of a deal because they're self-publishing this book, which I think is great. They're doing it themselves, but they do need to raise some money beforehand. So you go in, you pledge a dollar amount, and you can get autographed copies of the book. They're doing these scrapbooks. You and I were discussing this. These scrapbooks to me are fantastic. It's Bugsy's career. And the co-author, Ian Douglas, sent me a bunch of these photos, which are just mind-blowing. It's like Bugsy's own personal photos from his youth.
Yes, photos that have never been seen before, Barry.
Right, exactly. And I'm only going to post 4, but there's like 500 in the book. So it's quite a lot. And then if you're a one of the high rollers, if you're, you know, if you're Mr. Vegas or Atlantic City, for $1,200, you, a group of friends, can actually go have a meal with Bugsy. He will sit with you. He will drink with you. He will tell you stories. And Bugsy's a great, which you're obviously going to hear. He's a great, great storyteller. So I fully encourage you. This is in my top five of professional wrestling books ever written. It may even be top three. It is that good. What I like about it, Jeff, and I mentioned this to you also, is that every word that I read, I hear Bugsy's voice, which I think is great. So it's written in a style that's reminiscent of Bugsy McGraw. But what I also really like is this is not a rehashing of the same shit you've read 50 million times before. This is, you know, you referenced the Dusty Rhodes story. Holy cow. Like, yeah, I read that, and I was blown away when I read that. So this is a book that you're definitely going to get. And if you can get in there, make a pledge, you can get an autographed copy of the book. There's 10 different tiers of what you can pledge and what you'll actually receive. And even for $10, you can get an autographed postcard from Bugsy. And it's a postcard of the actual cover of the book. So highly recommended. Please support this. This is the shit that we need to do as wrestling fans, as people who care about the history of professional wrestling. We need to support projects like this, because one day all this stuff is going to be gone, and all these stories that old timers like Bugsy McGraw, all these stories that these guys have are all kept in the vault. It's all kept in their heads. And if we don't get this stuff published, if we don't get it out there, there will be no records of this anywhere. This is super important.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better to myself, Barry. So before we go on, let me just tell you, since I didn't do it at the very beginning, what else we're going to be discussing. Today, we are going to be doing our first Movie of the Week. Movie of the Week, as selected by Barry or myself this week. It is my choice. Next week, it'll be Mr. Rose's choice. What we've done, as I'm sure most of you noted on the Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry message board, is we have sought out the participation of members of our message board. Just in case folks don't think that we state names of people on this podcast, because now is the time. Extend that hand, my brothers and sisters, and we will bring you in to the movie club here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. So we're going to talk about that movie. And of course, we are bringing back the top five list. And this week, Barry, very, very difficult topic to discuss, our top five TV show theme songs. And Barry, you and I were talking back and forth. This is a tough topic, my friend.
I haven't said this in the last few weeks, and it's something I used to say literally every episode, but I would say this was the toughest top five overall so far. I haven't said it lately, but this, Jeff, this was the toughest top five. And you and I were texting each other today, and I think you said, I've got like 20, and I had 20, and then I had my list, and then I changed it, and then I went back. And then we had a little bit of a controversy, did we not?
I think we did, my friend, because we were debating back and forth, should we include on the theme show topic songs or themes that only had instrumentals, that there were no lyrics to that. And so we weighed that back and forth. So I'm going to let Barry put his choices in. My choices, as I go down, all are theme songs with lyrics. I will say that. So that's coming towards the end of our show. Barry, before we go on, you are Mr. CWF here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. And today is the day we recorded this. We received unfortunate news that a mainstay of CWF for many years, a guy who, dare I say, was never put in a position to be a headliner, maybe not even a semi-main event guy, but a guy that would work on cards and always, always put forth a good effort and always entertained. Today, Barry, we lost Raul Mata, and I was wondering if you could give the folks some thoughts and some remembrances of the career of Raul Mata.
Yeah, this was a difficult one, and I got to tell you that, in a sense, I think, and we've discussed something about similar to this previously, and I fucked up, and I hadn't spoken to Raul in quite a while, and I should go back. Raul was very friendly with my father, thus was friendly with me when I was a kid, and we were actually friends with his family, with his wife and his son as well. And I'll tell this story. And I tried to get to Raul to come to one of our fan fests. We did four fan fests in a year and a half. And I tried to get Raul, and he was spending a lot of time in Mexico. He really was going back and forth between Tampa and Mexico, and I wasn't able to get in touch with him. And I really, it was somebody that I wanted to talk to, and a lot of it had to do with my dad, because they were they got along so well. And of course, I never made that contact. And when I saw that today, I literally, you know, I was very saddened by it. But it was another missed opportunity of not having closure with something. And we've discussed that, you know, your heroes die. And you know, if you miss an opportunity to see them or speak to them, whatever it is, you know, it's, you'll always go, fuck, I have this regret. What if? That being said, he was so talented as a professional wrestler, and sadly was egregiously, which is the first time I believe we ever used that word on Breaking Kayfabe with Badgern and Barry, he was egregiously misused in CWF. And CWF didn't make a lot of mistakes, but they made a big mistake with Raul Mata. And part of it was there was no love for luchadors in Florida. It's, you know, you could, there are certain territories, Texas, obviously, a larger Hispanic and Mexican population. California falls into that. Florida, not so much. But that being said, his talent was undeniable. He came in, his first match actually was on Miami Beach, June 2nd, 1976, against veteran Bill Costello. And he was different than anything we had ever seen before. About a month after that, he had a match on Miami Beach with Bob Orton Jr. that is probably in the top, and I've referenced this on the show, in the top 10 professional live wrestling matches I have ever seen. And Bob Orton Jr. at this stage was emerging as one of the greats of all time, and he was fantastic. And Mata was innovative. He was doing shit in Florida that we had never seen before. So the two of them together were like magic. And I just remember that night going, my God, it was middle of the card. I mean, it wasn't a main event by any stretch, but it blew away every other match. And I just was, you know, here I am 42 years later, I'm still talking about this match. He was a star in Mexico. He held multiple titles. He was a star in California and Los Angeles primarily, held multiple titles. Anybody that ever worked with Raul Mata will tell you that the guy had it. He was a legit talent that, for whatever the reason, and I will tell you the reason why, he just never got that break. And part of it was when he came to Florida, he met his wife, Beverly, and he fell in love and decided to stay in Florida. I believe all of her relatives were here and all of her family, her mother and her father. And Ozzy's all excited.
Yeah, boy.
Yeah, Ozzy, I start talking about Raul Mata, and that's it. Ozzy starts going nuts. And he met and fell in love with his wife, Beverly. Beverly was a beautiful, beautiful woman, and physically beautiful, but they were just the nicest people you could ever have hoped to meet. And, you know, there's all these sometimes, you know, preconceived notions of professional wrestlers, and sometimes it's accurate and sometimes it's not. Raul was a family man. He was just this sweet guy. He married this wonderful woman. She was a seamstress, and she would actually make a lot of the robes and the masks, kind of like what Johnny Walker, Mr. Wrestling 2, what his wife did for years. Raul's wife was making masks and robes for a lot of the guys in Florida. And Sweet Brown Sugar, in 1979, that mask was actually made by Raul's wife. So I think a lot of it is he never left Florida because she was here. She was a homesteader. He then became a homesteader. But he could have easily left and gone back to Mexico or Texas or California or even another territory and just gotten a push because he had it. He was that good. I'm going to tell you my favorite Raul Mata story. So in 1980, my father and I, my mother was out of town, and as I think I was 17 at this time. Was I 17? I was 16. And my dad and I were, it was always a bonding thing with my dad, professional wrestling. And he was going, he basically said, he goes, you know, your mom's out of town for the week. She's in Ohio. Do you want to, I'm going to take off a week from work do you want to go see wrestling in other cities? I mean, you know, really? You have to ask that fucking question. Right, you got to ask that question. So, you know, what made it cool and irresponsible at the same time was I was in school. This was not some sort of vacation or break. I was missing school for this, but I wasn't going to miss it this chance. And the truth was, looking back, being a parent now with a son who's 17, my dad wanted to spend time with me as that time becomes less frequent than it certainly was in our younger years. So, of course, I jumped at the chance. So we did Monday night in West Palm Beach, Tuesday night in Tampa. We stuck around for the TV tapings in Tampa Wednesday morning, drove back to Miami for the Wednesday night show. Thursday was dark. We did not go to Jacksonville, which I regret because I never saw a card in Jacksonville. Friday night, we did Fort Lauderdale, and then Saturday, we were in the car, and we went to Lakeland. So Tuesday we were in Tampa, and we basically we had told Raul Mata that we were coming to Tampa, and he said, oh, he goes, you're going to be my guest. We'll go out to dinner. I want you to meet my family. And, you know, he was my dad, and I should preface this too. So my dad was a regional sales manager for Levitt's Furniture. And he oversaw all southeastern states. And whenever any of the wrestlers needed furniture, he got them furniture at cost with no delivery fees. So our own Bruce Owens can tell you a lot of stories because my dad got him a lot of furniture in the years. So Raul was really, really appreciative of that. So we showed up to Tampa, and we got in fairly early, 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. And he took us to Duff's Smorgasbord, which I don't know if they're still around, but it was like one of these original buffet smorgasbord type of deals. You get in for like $6 and you can just eat, 50 fucking plates of food. So he took us out to dinner that night. We took a whole bunch of photos, which I cherish to this day because it's like me, it's my father, it's Raul, and Raul's holding his baby, who is his son. And it just was just a cherished moment. And it was a great trip overall, but he was just such a nice guy when, he kind of went the distance with that. You know, he always went above. And that was for Christmas that year, which I never forgot, and I can tell you I'm an idiot, but he actually gave me a sweet brown sugar mask that his wife had created. And, when I was in college 3-4 years later, whatever it was, I wound up selling that mask for like $50, which now I just sit here and fucking want to just bang my head up against the wall because of that. But a true talent, a really great, more importantly, a really great human being, never fully got over the loss of his wife. And I can tell you, there's some stuff that I probably won't discuss on air, but he never got over the loss of his wife. That was true, true love right there. And I think the last few years of his life, he was just sad because of that. So a loss. Again, we've lost somebody that is underrated or undervalued in professional wrestling. At the same time, you lost a great fucking guy. There's so many douchebags that walk the face of this fucking earth on a daily basis. And it is sad how, a lot of people, a lot of great people and good people either die young. And I believe this was sudden because I was trading messages today with his brother, Carlos. And of course, I have remorseful guilt now that I never reached out to Raul. So I reached out to his brother and I expressed my condolences, and he said it was sudden and unexpected. So I don't know the cause of death at this time, but yeah, I'm bummed out. And the last thing I want to do is bum anybody out on Christmas. So, I'm sure that Raul would tell you, have a cerveza, enjoy this holiday, and just have some good memories. That would be it.
Well, I'll tell you my memory very quickly of Raul Mata. Raul Mata was a guy that you saw in the magazines, the After magazines, that was wrestling out in California, and a guy that got I don't know if he was a main event guy out there, but a guy that was getting a push enough to where he was in the magazines. And then, of course, he comes to CWF and you see him being used as enhancement talent. And you're sitting there thinking, why is this guy? Why aren't they doing something with this guy? And of course, obviously, you just answered the question. However, besides that, my fondest memory of Raul Mata was before the I think it was Wrestle War 91 in St. Petersburg, was Flair and Fujinami, we had numerous people coming in from out of town. John Hitchcock, Bruce Mitchell, Gabriel Daigle, Linus Sargent, all these guys that I knew from the Observer sheets, and I'm sure I'm missing somebody. Sorry if I did. And they all came in to watch Flair Fujinami, which, of course, at the time was a big dream match. Well, the night before, they were having an independent card. And I want to say it was at a club or maybe a bar or something like that. And I reached out to Bruce Mitchell today before we started taping. And I said, do you remember this card? And he started telling me all kind of memories of that show. And I was like, man, we got to have Bruce Mitchell out here to talk about this show, because there was a couple of really funny incidents that took place. But the main event on that show that night, and Barry, I had asked you before if you were there that night, and you unfortunately said you were not, was Raul Mata working a main event against veteran Florida enhancement guy slash independent guy, Nasty Ned Brady. And so here they are in front of all these smart marks, and I'm here to tell you, they tore the fucking house down. And it was an amazing, amazing match. And both guys, at the end of the night, we just couldn't believe how great this match was. And I remember the next day we went to Malenko's training school, and Nasty Ned Brady was there. I guess he was helping them instruct. And he was completely overwhelmed by the amount of praise that he got for how great that match was. And Raul Mata really showed his stuff that night and showed everyone how great he still was and how much of a talent that Eddie Graham and the folks at CWF missed out on for whatever reason, Barry. And but just so we raise an adult beverage to Raul Mata in his memory, we will raise a cerveza, since Barry has indicated that that may have been his beverage of choice. Now it is time, Barry, finally here on Breaking Kayfabe, it is time for our movie of the week. And here's the way it works, folks. Barry, why don't you just give a quick explanation about the Google thing and how that's going to work, because you're much better at that than I am.
Yeah, so we actually made a slight alteration to that. So this is a really, really simple premise. And I apparently last week it was a little convoluted when I explained it, or I certainly confused Travis Raines, because he made that
I don't know if that's really hard to do.
Right, exactly. I don't think that was going to be too hard. But basically, Jeff and I are going to alternate choices. One week Jeff will choose, the next week I will choose. We will pick out, and Jeff will pick out three, then I'll pick out three. We'll pick out three group members. We have a list now, Jeff. It's what, like 90 names on that list?
Well, let's just say that, folks, we are set for the next 12 weeks with
there you go. I think it's even more than that. Yeah. It was, and today people were still, and I was getting messages, and I kept saying, you got to go to the thread. You've got to get your name. But again, it's simple. We will choose three group members to watch a movie. We give them roughly 5 or 6 days to watch it, and then all they have to do is email both Jeff and myself their reviews. Then we'll discuss the movie, and we're going to read some of the quotes of the group members who reviewed the movie with us. So simple stuff.
Yeah. And so what we did was it's actually kind of a funny story. I decided, based on the conversation we had last week, was I said, hey, why don't we do Billy Jack? I thought that'd be a great choice. And of course, I went looking for Billy Jack, and the only place it's available is on YouTube, but you have to pay a fee. I want this to be something that, you know, someone's not going to have to pay a fee for. It's either going to be out there for free on YouTube, on Netflix, on HBO for, you know, extended showings, or one of the other, you know, Showtime stars, whatever. But I want it to be something that's accessible to people. And so what I did was I went to the old Netflix. I was actually looking for Billy Jack, didn't find that. So I'm scanning through, going through, trying to see something that piques my interest. And lo and behold, when I got to the true crime documentary, I came across this movie. And when I did, and I started looking, and one of the great things about Netflix that, holy crap, is this a great innovation that they do, Barry, is when you click on the movie, they'll give you like about a 30-second trailer of what's coming up and what the show's about or what the movie's about. And that's really, to me, it really is so helpful. And I started watching the trailer for this movie, and I went, holy shit, not only have I found it, Barry Rose is going to lose his effing mind when I tell him about this. And I told him about a movie called Long Shot, and it's a movie that came out in 2017. Barry, you want to tell them real quick about what it was that appealed to you about this movie?
Yeah, so, and we should say too that if you have not seen this movie and you want to see this movie, you may just want to lower the volume a little bit, because we are going to be discussing quite a few spoilers. But yeah, so the first thing, when you sent me the text about your choice, you told me something and I was like, fuck yeah, I'm in. So there is a major twist to this story, and it involves Larry David and Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, and it's, you know, here's another thing about this movie. The movie is, I'll give you the basic premise. Guy is charged with a capital murder in Los Angeles when he retains counsel. Of course, he's in custody. He's grilled by the police officers, who are sure they got the right guy. And the guy swears that it's not him. He had nothing to do with this. And he, through that, with the help of a friend, he retains a very, very sharp lawyer who comes in. And of course, the first question he says to the guy is, what's your alibi? And the guy's like, I didn't do this. And he didn't even know. He says, what night did this happen? And the lawyer tells him the night it happened. And he says, well, wait a minute, wasn't that around Mother's Day? And the lawyer says, yeah. He goes, oh, that's when I took my daughter to the Dodgers game. And at that point, the ball starts rolling down the hill as they try to pursue all avenues to come up with this guy's alibi. And did I say the name of the movie, Barry?
You did.
Okay. I was like, yeah. Wow, what a dumb shit. So as the lawyer is investigating all sort of avenues and is like, you know, geez, there were this ball game, because it was Mother's Day weekend. There's like, you know, 50,000 people at the Dodgers game. How the hell am I going to find out whether or not this guy was there? You know, does this guy have a ticket stub? They start going through all kind of different avenues, something that can help this guy with an alibi, because the guy swears he had nothing to do with it. Now, the little side twist is, apparently, the victim, who was a young lady, I want to say she may have still been a teenager, Barry.
She was 16 years old.
Okay, you are correct. 16 years old. The belief by the police was she may have been murdered as retribution for testifying against his brother, who was involved with some kind of shenanigans there, dare I say. So that was their motive, that, you know, he was getting the girl back for something she had, I guess she had squealed on his brother for something. So the guy swears he didn't do it. So the lawyer starts going through all the police work, or going through all the evidence. And he decides to go to the Los Angeles Dodgers and ask them if they have any crowd shots, you know, from the television broadcast that night. The guy sits there and starts painstakingly going through the tape of that night's game, trying just to find this guy in the crowd. OK, doesn't find anything, needle in the haystack. And then the guy, the defendant, by the way, I should mention the defendant's name is Juan Catalan. And Juan Catalan tells his attorney, oh, you know, there was something else that was going on that night. And his attorney says, what do you mean? He says, well, they were filming something. I don't know what it was, but there was some kind of filming going on. So the lawyer reaches back out to the Dodgers and says, you know, did you have some other kind of camera crew there like that night? And lo and behold, they go back and check their records and find out that Larry David was filming a scene for the TV show Curb Your Enthusiasm, which, of course, Barry is a huge, huge fan of. And I have not seen all the episodes, but it's a very funny show. And apparently, Barry, tell us about that episode of Curb.
Yeah, so this is one of my favorite episodes. And it wasn't even about the Dodgers, and I'll tell you why at the very end. But this is an episode where he is trying to get to a Dodger game, and he's got to pick up a prostitute. They call them crack whores, Barry, though I don't think she was on crack. But he has to pick up a prostitute in order to get into the speed lane. What do they call that in Los Angeles, where you've got to have somebody next to you?
Yeah, like the high-volume lane or whatever.
Yeah, you got to have like two or three people. I forget what they call it. So he gets a hooker, he pays her, takes her to the game, and it's just – she's great. It's great. There's all these
H-O-V
little stuff.
H-O-V lane. Thank you, sweet Lou.
Luke, there it is, ladies and gentlemen. The producer, Luke Kippelman, coming. What's it called?
The H-O-V lane.
The H-O or the carpool lane. Beautiful. Exactly. I love it. That's exactly what it is. We don't have that here in Pennsylvania or Florida, if I'm correct. But anyways, it's a fantastic episode. So when you told me this was what it was about, Jeff, I immediately got excited. But please continue.
So then they actually, on the movie, have Larry David discussing how this attorney had come to him, explained the situation, and wanted to see, I guess, the proverbial dailies, the raw footage of the show, just to see if they can find this guy in a crowd shot, because the guy had said they were filming right by my section. So again, complete needle in a haystack. And you know, the thing is, Barry, as much as I enjoy talking about this movie because I loved it, I really don't want to give away everything that happens in the movie, because literally until the last 5 seconds of the show, something else is revealed at the very end of the show or at the end of the movie that makes it complete, even more completely amazing. There's like it's like a dusty fucking finish to this movie. Just when you think the movie's over, oh, there's one more thing that happens. Oh, and there's one more little detail that comes out, and it's absolutely fucking amazing. So what we want to do, I tell you what I'm going to do, Barry. Let's go and look at the reviews as we have assigned them, and now the names can be revealed, Barry. And I will tell you, good folks, that this week's guest reviewers were Mark Hertweck, Benji Fido, and Kevin Carter. So, Barry, you want to take the first review? You got it there handy?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So do we want to do the entire review, or do we just want to pull select quotes?
Go ahead, because and I will say, for the three gentlemen, wow, you guys completely knocked it out of the park. I was really expecting, like, it was a good movie, I liked it, da-da-da-da-da. These guys sat down like they were writing for the fucking Chicago Trib, and they knocked out a Gene Siskel-esque review. I mean, they really went to journalism school, and guys, you did a great job. And we will post the reviews on the Breaking Kayfabe message board. So, Barry, which one are you going to take first?
I will take Kevin Carter because it's actually directly in front of me.
Okay. Why don't you tell the folks what Kevin Carter thought of the movie?
Yeah, absolutely, too. So I'm going to start at the beginning, and I'll probably just pull a few select quotes from it. But I agree with you. All three of these reviews were great. They gave a synopsis of the film with their own personal observations. I'm not going to read the whole synopsis part because you don't need to hear the gist of the story from five different people. But I'm going to read you either more of their quotes or their observations of the film. But Kevin Carter, our friend Kevin Carter, says, "When I first watched Long Shot, I wondered why Bowdrin and Barry wanted me to watch a movie about a 6'6" transgender who was smuggling cheap fake silicone butt plugs from China three at a time. Then I realized I was supposed to watch Long Shot on Netflix instead of Pornhub."
Barry, what is this Pornhub that he refers to? Anyway, I digress. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know what? Our friend Jeff Singer could probably tell us exactly.
No.
Yeah, maybe Mr. New Wave Hookers. Maybe. I saw that post. But Kevin, obviously, I think he watched this more than once because he's pretty detailed with his notes here. But he goes, "Just from the police interviews, we get to hear on the documentary that Juan was never, quote, innocent until proven guilty, end quote. He was more, quote, guilty, and we will prove it by making the evidence fit. And it would have worked, too, if it wasn't for a meddling lawyer named Todd Melnick. Finding Melnick is the first of several long shots that take Juan from a slam-dunk death penalty case to being a free man." These long shots include an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, shooting an episode live at Dodger Stadium, to Larry David hiring a self-proclaimed shitty PA to cell phone evidence. If I was reviewing a work of fiction, I would say it depends entirely too much on pure dumb luck and happenstance. Unfortunately, this is a real story, and a man's life hung in the balance, and the only thing that kept him from prison was pure dumb luck and Larry David's Curb Your Enthusiasm. Speaking of Larry David, he may be the only person in Hollywood self-deprecating enough to make the fact that he saved a man from at least life in prison and possibly being put to death and make jokes about it." So, Kevin liked the movie.
Okay, I'm going to read Mark I'm butchering Mark's name. I apologize. Hertweck. He says, "Long Shot is a Netflix original documentary about the murder of a young woman, an alibi, and an unbelievable true story with a Hollywood twist. In May 2003, 16-year-old Martha Pueblo was shot in the head on the doorstep of her Los Angeles home days after testifying in a gangland murder trial. Police arrested then 24-year-old Juan Catalan at gunpoint, alleging that he had carried out the hit for his gangster brother Mario. During the ensuing police interviews, Catalan insisted he didn't kill Puebla, and they have the wrong man. As the trial unfolds, Catalan's lawyer, Todd Melnick, sets out to prove his innocence and ultimately turns to an unlikely source, footage from the HBO hit comedy Curb Your Enthusiasm, whose crew was filming an episode at Dodger Stadium that day. to help prove he was at the baseball game with his daughter at the time of the murder. Let's see, I'm going to skip ahead to a couple of two things that really stand out about this film. Number one, after doing some additional research on the story, apparently the real killer, this is great, Barry, was kind of upset with the director and producers because his name was never mentioned in the credits of the movie. That's very funny stuff, Mark. Good stuff. Number two, and finally, an even bigger twist in the ending of the original story, the version I watched, perhaps the director's cut, including Joshua Greenbaum making a surprise post-credit cameo appearance and a teaser to the upcoming and long-awaited sequel, Long Shot 2, Greenbaum's Revenge. I digress about that. So he says, Long Shot is definitely worth the watch. It was an interesting true crime documentary with a unique ending. And on the Zaha scale of ratings, I give it 3 million thumbs up. So great stuff. And you want to take Benji's?
Yeah, well, you know, and Mark also has one more quote that I liked, and it was, and we can share Benji's at that point too. But Mark says, while I normally prefer my documentaries a bit grittier, Long Shot, despite centering around a murder, certainly displays more of a lighthearted tone at times, as evidenced by Larry David delivering the best line in the entire film when he deadpans, "You're right to refer to me as a mega huge Hollywood star. That's totally accurate." It's not often that such a comedy titan pops up in a true crime documentary, and the heartwarming ending certainly helps provide more proof that the world is a better place with Curb Your Enthusiasm in it. I'd agree with that.
Yeah, absolutely. That was good stuff. So Benji Fido says, August 12th and May 12th, 2 days that Juan Catalan will never forget. August 12th because it was the day he was arrested for the murder of 16-year-old Martha Puebla, and May 12th because he went to an L.A. Dodgers game, and being at that game, a game he wasn't supposed to be at, would change his life in ways he couldn't begin to imagine. Thus begins the Netflix documentary Long Shot, a quick talking head documentary. And by the way, folks, let me just inform you, lest you think that this is one of these documentaries that's going to tie you down with, three or four different parts, 6 hours. No, 40 minutes tops. Bada boom, bada bing. You're in, you're out. A quick talking head documentary that gives you all the facts by people telling you the story rather than showing you. Case in point, during the film, you see the video of the lead detectives on the case being interviewed, and what you as the viewer can only assume. And remember, boys and girls, assuming makes an ass out of you and me, is a trial of some kind that you are given no background on until the end of the film, where everything is tied together. The film moves very quickly, focusing a great deal of its time on the Dodgers games that Juan and his six-year-old daughter, his cousin, and her friend attended on May 12th, the day when the murder took place. Juan's lawyer painstakingly goes over the footage from the game, hoping to catch even a glimpse of Juan at the game. He eventually does. However, the footage is too grainy to clearly see Juan. Enter Larry David and HBO, who just happened to be at the ballpark that night shooting footage for an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm, which Larry David picks up a hooker so he can ride in the carpool lane. Name that name of the episode. By the way, do you know what the name of the episode was, Barry?
I don't know. The hooker? I don't know what it was
called. I don't know. Okay. So, boy, okay. See, I thought you knew everything about it. And takes her to the Dodger game. Now, they shot that night in two sections. They just couldn't stop people from walking while they were filming. So in the shot, you see Juan walking back to his seat with his daughter. You think, okay, case over, right? Nope, wrong. Wrong. Thank you for this comment, Benji. He says, wrong as in walking in and seeing your grandma naked, wrong. Even when the video evidence, the timestamp on the tape still makes it too early, which means Juan could have left the game and still committed the murder. Scratching your head thinking, wait, they have the tape. What else do they want? A lot. You have a prosecutor nicknamed, it's never good when a prosecutor gets a nickname like this, Barry. They called her the Sniper, which sounds like a bad wrestling gimmick given to some poor bastard in the WWF back in the 80s who picks
right,
off.
Oh, I got to stop right there. So there was a sniper at one point in professional wrestling played by Rip the Crippler Oliver. And that was one of his many gimmicks. He was the Sniper. He was also Gestapo. But that actually was a wrestling gimmick at one point.
All right. Good call, Benji. Bet you didn't know that. Who picks off people who committed murder by giving them the death penalty and who has never lost a case. So more she shall have in the form of cell tower information, which shows where the cell phone pinged off when Juan made the call to his girlfriend after the game, which shows that he was still at Dodger Stadium and was not anywhere near the scene where the murder took place. So I will say that I'm just trying to think. He kind of goes over what the other guy says. Now, before I wrap up this interview, let me speak on Larry David. Now, he seems like a nice man who is very happy to help Juan out. However, he just came off as, hey, look at me. It's because of me that Juan's free. Well, that is partially true. If Larry David hadn't been there, things would have turned out differently for Juan. It's just that when Larry said that he gets asked about it and tells a story at parties, it bothered me a great deal. To me, he could have been a little bit more humble. That's just his opinion, though. The film, 40 minutes, fast-paced storytelling. It does hold you. And if you knew nothing about this case, as I did, it's very interesting. It gives you a pause about what-ifs, which are a huge part of this film. I would recommend it as something to watch because though all the silliness with Larry David and his co-star Kim Whitley, who plays the hooker, who they also interviewed, which is very funny, it does stay with you after you watch it and makes you think about what you would do in Juan's case. I know it makes me think especially about calling someone after I leave an event. He gives the film 3 stars. So first of all, Barry, Breaking Kayfabe, round of applause for all 3 gentlemen for their assistance on this. We really do appreciate it, guys. Barry, I strongly recommend this film. Again, 40 minutes, bada boom, bada bing. A great story, a very interesting case study. And again, what I really liked about it is it's something where at the very end, what was the movie about the guy with the neck collar?
The one we watched on Netflix like a year ago.
Yeah. Like that film. Yeah. I'm completely drawing a blank.
I don't remember yet.
Lou, clue me in.
Come on, Lou.
But it's like that. And literally the last 30 seconds of the movie, something else is revealed that you hadn't seen before. And it makes you kind of sit there at the very end of the movie and go, holy shit. And it's pretty, pretty compelling stuff, Barry. First of all, I'm assuming that you would give this movie a thumbs up.
Oh, you would get a huge thumbs up from me, too. So first off, I love the fact that it is not a – so I tried to watch that Staircase one. Remember that? And I think I made it 2 or 3 episodes, and I was just like, God, man, it's moving. It's moving a little slow, and it made me think that, okay, this is a great story if you cut this in half. You don't need to stretch this out. 40 minutes for somebody with ADD like me, this is fantastic. So I love that aspect of it. Juan Catalan, right from the get-go, seems sincere and genuine. And I didn't know how the story was going to turn out. I had my suspicions. I tried not to read too much into it, but he seemed really, really genuine. There was a lot of tears. There was a lot of welling up, and you could just – there was something about him. This guy did not come off like this hardened gangster, you know. It just seemed like it's just a nice guy who was with his family and trying to do the right thing. And the two cops, and again, we're not, you know, I guess we could talk about it a little bit. The two cops basically admitted to railroading him, that they led him down the wrong path.
Evil genius, Barry. How can we forget?
That was from you, actually, right? You actually researched that one.
How can we forget, Jeff?
It's been a year. That's how we fucking forget, right?
So, in
a nutshell, this is a great movie. Juan Catalan is a just comes across as a real decent human being. The sniper, you know what, Jeff? I wasn't a fan of the sniper. She comes across as this mean, vindictive, cold bitch in this. And this is archival footage. First off, this wasn't something that was shot recently. So they're showing footage from 15 years ago when they show that. She comes across terribly, you know, as I'm watching this. It was kind of sweet. The ending is great, and I believe it was Benji or Mark or Kevin, but somebody mentioned when he's released from jail, his daughter runs up to give him a hug, and she's a little confused, I guess. She's a very young child. She looks about 4 or 5 or 6 at that when it happened, but his lawyer, there are periods. And, you know, I get, Jeff, you certainly would have a different opinion of lawyers because you've worked hand in hand with lawyers for over 32 years. But the general perception of lawyers is not always positive. We could agree on that.
Well, I will say this.
Sure.
Much like anything, much like cops, politicians. Okay. Yes, there are good lawyers and bad lawyers. I have met good people that are lawyers, and I've met guys that are complete scumbags. But your point,
Qualman, who's a great friend of ours, is just a great guy. Also, I think the point I was trying to make is pardon me, is that there's a lot of lawyer jokes. There's just the perception of lawyers, and I sometimes wonder if we all think that. And I look, there are great lawyers, there are scumbags. I get that, but at the same time, to see his lawyer well up with tears when he's talking about him, and then when he's released from prison, that man had one of the biggest smiles on his face and gave him the biggest hug when he was released, and it was genuine. And I can tell you by watching it, I believed every second of it. That was a genuine emotion right there from his lawyer. His lawyer, in my opinion, believed in his innocence from the get-go and fought to get him freed and did it. The ending is, if you don't get a little tear in the eye, you need to check yourself. It's a sweet ending, and it's kind of great. And I will tell you, the ending shot is Juan Catalan, and this is some 15 years later, sitting in Dodger Stadium in the same seats with his daughter, who is now grown up. And she's got to be 18 years old or so, or certainly close to, maybe even 20. And then they kind of pan away from them. And as I'm watching and I'm going, God, that's just great filmmaking, but really, really sweet. We do have one little controversy, though, Jeff, that I think we need to address.
Lay it on me.
Benji Fido was not a fan of having Larry David in the documentary.
Well, Larry David, for better or worse, was a major part of why this guy's a free man today. I mean, how can you not have him in there?
And I think he says that too. I think he felt that, that it was a little silly, and he felt that it was, and quoting him, let me speak on Larry David. Now, he seems like a nice man. You know it's going to go south from there when someone says that.
That's like saying, Barry, I don't mean any disrespect, but.
can I just be honest with you? Right, yeah, exactly. You're about to get fucked right now, and you're going to get fucked hard. So, okay, let me speak on Larry David. Now, he seems like a nice man who was very happy to help Juan out. However, he just came off as, hey, look at me. It's because of me that Juan's free. Well, that is partially true. If Larry David hadn't been there, things would have turned out differently for Juan. But Benji, I don't think was, I guess maybe he's not a fan of Curb, or maybe he is. I don't know. But I don't know. It seemed like everybody else, for me, look, that was a highlight. And that's Larry David's. That's his MO. In a sense, he doesn't come off as a guy with this huge ego. It's the self-deprecating stuff that Howard Stern does as well. And whether it's true or not, they both do that. So for me, I get Larry David more mocking himself, which is something that he does all the time. When you told me, Curb and Larry David, I was like, fuck, I got to watch this. So yeah.
Yeah.
It's huge thumbs up for me.
Yeah. Good stuff. Very compelling reviews by all three guys. We once again say thank you very much. We will have a new group of three that I am, at the time of this recording, preparing to reach out to. So what will happen is I will reach out to you if you have been selected for that week's movie, and we will give you an update as to what the movie is and give you X amount of time to watch that movie and send in. The guys were extremely generous in sending in, a couple paragraphs. Folks, we don't need you to be a journalist, okay? Just, you can tell us I like the movie or not and give us a few details. These three guys all really came through, though, and offered some pretty insightful thoughts and insightful commentary, and we really appreciate it. Hey, Barry, guess what time it is? Now it is time for us to take a look and our discussion with Florida legend, wrestling legend, Bugsy McGraw. And Barry, you think it's time for us to go to that interview and listen to some great stories from the road from Bugsy?
Oh, I'm excited for this. Absolutely.
Okay. So now, folks, here we're going to go to our interview with Bugsy McGraw. Okay. Well, we'd like to welcome Bugsy McGraw to Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdren and Barry. Bugsy, it's a pleasure to have you with us. And we're gonna talk a little bit about Bugsy's new autobiography, which is called Brute Power. And Brute I have power. To tell you, Barry and I have both read it. And Barry, I know you agree with me. This is a fantastic read.
Yeah, so this is one of my – this automatically became one of my favorite wrestling books. And I got to say, first off, I'm very friendly with not only Bugsy but his co-author, who is Ian Douglas, based out of Michigan. And Ian reached out and he said, hey, would you mind reading this book? I mean, he came to me, the biggest geek wrestling fan of old school wrestling, and said, would you do me a favor and would you read this book and let me know what you think? And, you know, I couldn't even get the words out quick enough. Of course I would. So Ian sent me a copy of this book and I sat down, and I want to say it was around 7:30 at night, with the intention of reading a few chapters and calling it a night. And the next thing I know, it's midnight and I have finished the book. So to tell you that, I jumped in with both feet. I was super excited. And this is a great book, Jeff. And I was raving about this book to anybody that would listen at the last CWF Legends Fan Fest, because, and I've told Bugsy this, and I've told you this, Jeff, when I read this book, A, there was a ton of new information that I never knew about Bugsy. And this was somebody that I saw wrestle for 20-something years. But I also, every page and every word, I could hear Bugsy's voice. So this immediately shot up to the top of my favorite wrestling books of all time.
Yeah, it's a fantastic read. One of the things that I particularly loved about it, Bugsy takes us back to the very early days when he was first being trained by Tom Jones and was introduced to the original Sheik in Michigan. And Bugsy, quite the life that you've led, I will say, my man.
Well, you know, it's very, very true. I'd have to say that as I look back, you know, when you're looking back, you got to turn around and go, wow, all these things happened to me. And, you know, there's just a lot of things that happen that are actually truly unbelievable. I've been blessed in the name of Jesus Christ. You can't believe how many times I should have, one time. Let me tell you this, because, as a child of God, back about 5 years ago, I was riding home and pulling my car, and the Lord asked me three questions. It was amazing. I don't know why he chose that time. I don't know why he chose the questions, but the first one was, how many times? Josh, should you be dead? I said, about 5 or 6, I think. He goes, no, many more. Second question, how many times should you be in jail? I said, many. He said, you're right, many. Third question, how many times should you be poor and also, absolutely have nothing? I said, many. And he said, that's right. And then he left. Didn't ask me any more questions, you know. It's like, so I have to look back and, you know, and I have to consider that, you know, with all the ins and outs and the turns and the maneuvers and everything that happens in life, I've had some things happen that were unbelievable, and I've been blessed.
Well, I think that without question, one of the things that really appealed to me about the book is you certainly pull no punches. You talk about people that you liked, that you got along with. And by the same token, if you feel like somebody was doing you wrong or somebody was not appreciative of your talents, you don't have a problem saying that you didn't particularly care for the person. And without giving away too many of the stories, because, of course, we want to help you market this book. There's some great stories. And another thing I love is that you visited so many different territories. You were definitely not a homesteader, Bugsy. You got around to a lot of different territories.
Yeah, you know, I had the chance. Well, you know, it would all depend on the situation. And then, there's certain things that you can't accept, and there's other things that you can't accept, you know, like, you know, the way you're treated by the promoter, the money, the trips, on and on. And then you go, well, you know, I've had enough. And, you know, I want to, move on. So I did, you know, but every situation that you're involved with, you have to realize is not perfect. So, you know, I just, there's a few places that I was at, you know, like, for a while, you know, that's what I mean. Like I went to Vancouver for a couple of years. I was in Florida for 3 years. Other places, you know.
Well, you had your places that you did that you were successful at, as you mentioned, in Vancouver and Florida. And then you you also tell stories about places that maybe you didn't enjoy so much, like one winter in Calgary, which.
Oh, yeah. You know, that was, that's a story and a half, you know, the trip there and.
Yeah, that couple of months in Calgary was the longest year of your life, on Bucks.
It was a cold winter, one of the coldest they ever had. And it's like, you know, I drove to Calgary and I parked my car and I checked in the hotel. And then in the morning, I went out to start my car. The car would not even turn, not even a sound. And I didn't realize, you know, it completely froze up. And so they told me, what you need is a freeze plug. I had to go get a free plug, you know, well, I had to get the car towed. It wouldn't even start. And all of that. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, you know, with all the things that happen, you know, in that type of weather. Yeah, that's just one thing that happened in Calgary. Yeah.
Yeah, so Bugsy, I want to go back to really in your formative years as well. And I think one of the things I really loved about your book was it was your life. It was your life really from start to the point that you're at now. And I really enjoyed the early years of your career, but also the fact that you were growing up in Indianapolis and you really had a chance to see what was arguably some of the best wrestling in the United States with guys like Cowboy Bob Ellis and Dick the Bruiser and Wilbur Snyder. What was that like, though, as far as developing you as a fan of professional wrestling, being able to see these guys?
Well, you know, it actually was, you know, I would say it was amazing, actually, because I was a kid, you know, roughly 14, 15, 16, and wrestling was new there. When I say new, I mean on, you know, on the television. And it was so hot. I mean, unbelievably hot. They were drawing all the time. I don't care where they went. And see, the other thing that was exciting, the people to live the second house from us, the man was one of the referees. So he would take me and his young son, you know, every so often. And we got to see the matches, and you know, it's like, you know what you said there. You know, you have some, you know, you have some exciting names there: the Bruisers, the Cowboy Ellis, Wilbur Snyder, Yukon Eric, the Sheik. You know, the Bruiser was like, I mean, he was electrifying. I used to sit there in a crowd and I watch him. He walk out of the dressing room. And he would walk up the ringside, at the end of ringside, I'm talking about, the end of it, right? He'd stand there with his hands on his hips. The crowd would go crazy after a while. He'd just stand there and look around. Crowd would go crazy because they knew when he got in the ring, there was going to be a fight. You know, so, you know, I mean, it's like, I mean, it was amazing. You would talk to people, you know, how. Well, you know how the fans are, the average individual is. They, you know, they start in about professional wrestling. Well, you know, I really believe that professional wrestling is, you know, oh, it's kind of phony, but not the Bruiser. He's not. I mean, he was over. I mean, he got over, you know, like he was really super tough. And actually he was, you know.
Well, that's like, you know, the fans in the Northeast and New York City and that part of the country were famous for saying that, oh, well, maybe pro wrestling's fake. But Bruno Sammartino's matches, they're 100% on the level. And that was part of the appeal of bringing the people in the Northeast into the arenas, was that their belief that Bruno's matches were completely on the level. And as a matter of fact, since I just brought up Bruno, you had a chance to appear against Bruno in Madison Square Garden. I believe it was a handicap match with you and Captain Lou Albano against Bruno. And I recall, this is also in the book, but there's a great story that you told at our fan fest one year about something you decided, where you decided you were going to show up Bruno in the ring. Can you tell us that story, Bugsy?
Oh, absolutely. Bruno Sammartino, you know, he was called in the living legend, and he was. I mean, this guy, he was like, strong, you know, really strong. I mean, this guy was a strong man. He was in shape. Now, when I say in shape, I mean not just, you know, you say, he was in excellent shape. He was beyond that. This guy, I mean, he was in fantastic shape. And so I had heard a lot about him and the fact that he was in shape and he was really strong. So I knew I was strong too. You know, I could press over 500 pounds anytime I wanted to, you know? And so I got to thinking about it. I thought, okay, Bruno Sammartino, the living legend, you're really strong. You're really in shape. Well, I knew I was in shape, see, because I trained a lot. I was in great shape. So, man, I'm walking in the ring and I'm thinking, Bruno, tonight, your night, I'm going to blow you up. You're going to be so tired, you can hardly crawl or walk. I go in that ring, and boy, I took it to him. I mean, I took it to him as hard as I could. And I can remember one time I ended up in the corner on my knees. I looked over at the other corner. He's in the other corner, and he's jumping up and down. He's dancing. And I thought, you son of a bitch. And I got up and I charged him again, and we went at it. I mean, you know, I have a lot of respect for him. He could go.
Yeah, Bruno too. Bruno was one of those guys that we didn't see him a lot down in the state of Florida, but based out of New York, he had arguably the most exposure of any world's heavyweight champion because the magazines were also based out of New York. I want to talk about a guy, Bugsy, that was really instrumental in the development of your career in your early days, which was Tom Jones. And I'm not talking about, it's not unusual to be loved by somebody, Tom Jones. I'm talking about a guy who was a professional wrestler for probably 40 years, and I know that he was in every territory. We saw him in Florida. We saw him in Florida in the late 60s, and then he came back again in 1975, and just a stellar worker. What are your memories of Tom?
Well, Tom Jones was nice to me. I was trying to find, I was in Indianapolis. You know, I was about 22, and I wanted to find someone to help me or to train me so I could become a professional wrestler. And I forget exactly how I found him, but I found him and I asked him, you know, to train me. And he said, yeah. And, you know, he went, so he actually helped me, And, you know, we would go down to the YMCA on the mats. You know, that was a hard surface. I remember taking one, you know, like a hip toss, and I landed, and it hurt. I mean, it really hurt, you know. And he looked at me, and he said, how did that feel? And I said, it hurt, so let's do it again. And I kept on, you know, because I realized, you know, if you can't take the pain, you can't do the time, you know. So, yeah. And then later on, he took me up to, because he was working a lot for the Sheik up in Detroit. So he took me to see the Sheik. And, you know, she, you know, he had a reputation. I mean, this guy was something. He was really something. I like the Sheik, but I mean, this guy, you know, I wouldn't.
Let me ask you, Bugsy. I don't mean to interrupt. You know, you, one of the things you talked about in the books were, you know, you were in different places and the reactions that different, whether it's Bruno in the Northeast, the way the crowd reacted to Bruno, the way the crowd reacted to the Sheik in Detroit. Had you ever before seen a guy get the kind of heat that the Sheik got coming to the ring? Like you talked about how Dick the Bruiser, how the fans reacted to him, the way the fans reacted, of course, in a negative way to the Sheik. Was there anybody that you saw in your career that compared to that?
Probably, you know, I've seen a few that could probably come close, but nobody that could, you know, I mean, this guy could start, he could start a riot because they, I mean, and I've seen him start them. You know, I mean, I've seen the fans go absolutely berserk in Detroit. You know, at Cobo Hall. Oh my God! You know. I mean, they wanted to kill him, absolutely dead. This guy could get some serious heat, and he was prepared for anything. Believe me, he had all kinds of weapons in the trunks. Believe me, and he was prepared to use them too.
Well, and you mentioned when he comes to the ring with his the robe and the headpiece and stuff like that he came packing because there was something hidden in pretty much every part of that robe.
Oh yeah. I mean, if he, one time later on, you know, I think I don't know where we were. So maybe Japan together, but you know, he showed me, you know, he had on his trunks and he lifted up the trunks a little bit and he had about six weapons inside that trunk, and inside his trunk. I mean, he was prepared for anything, and you know, he would use it too.
Wow, gotcha. So one of my favorite heels of all time, and this was somebody that you also thanked in your book, is Killer Carl Cox. And Jeff will tell you, you know, I'm a huge Killer Carl Cox fan. I love Cox, actually. And he was instrumental in really helping you out during one of your tours of Australia.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. You know, he was, we went to Australia. I went over there and, like, you know, Jim Barnett was having a hard time and we were the new crew. And I ended up, I'm just a young guy, right? And, you know, and I'm new. I've been working for about a year and a half maybe. And I became the head heel, you know, so we're trying to draw money with Mario Milano. Now, he lived there. He lived in Melbourne. And then later on, well, I think about 2 months after that, yeah, he brought in Cox. And we were a tag team. And that's when the territory really took off. We started drawing money. Cox was a master. He was a true master. He knew how, you know, manipulate the crowd. He knew how to work. And also, you know, this is a guy, too, that if you put him in, well, in the right situation, so he'd fight, you know what I mean? Yeah, he would really fight. So, you know, so I got along with him and, yeah, we traveled together all the time. And I just, you know, because I was young and green and we're working for Jim Barnett. So I had, let me think, what did I say in here? Yeah, Jim Barnett. So, you know, anything that Carl would say, I just go, yep, I agree. You know, that's all I do. Because he knew how to handle him. I didn't, you know, I mean, yeah, Jim Barnett was.
You know, well, and again, one of the things you talk about in the book, again, the book is called Brute Power by Ian Douglas and Bugsy McGraw. And you talk about the way that Barnett would manipulate people and how he basically tried to, for lack of a better way of putting it, hold you hostage in Australia when you were trying to make a shot in Hawaii, correct?
Yeah, well, that you know, what I say, when I came in at that time, they were actually, he had a partner, I believe his partner name was Lonnie. I think it was Lonnie anyway. And they were actually, you know, they were considering closing the territory because, you know, they weren't having any success. Now, this is before I arrived. So when I, yeah, so when I arrived, you know, like I was it, I was the heel, you know. So we drew some, myself and Milano, we started to draw, and then he brought in Cox. And then the Cox and I, you know, we really started to draw. And it went well from there. It went very well. And Jim Barnett, yeah, he was a manipulator. He would use anything and everything. You'll see in the book how he was using prostitutes and, you know, I mean, you name it. And so he was capable.
Yeah, and that's just one of the things that Bugsy discusses in the book that we it's part of the reason Barry and I recommend it so much, right, Barry?
It isn't often that we have a guest on that's talking about a promoter using prostitutes to manipulate. So yes, that will definitely help sell the book, but it certainly is it's a fantastic read. I found the chapter on Australia too. To me, that's such a golden era of professional wrestling, and you had such a great crew there of guys, and you really had some of the greatest baby faces and heels I think of all time were all working out of Australia at one time or another. Bugsy, would you agree with that?
Oh, I would, because Jim Barnett now, you know, he had promoted before up in Indianapolis and Atlanta and other places, and he was always successful. So he would always, he'd always try to use the top talent. And, you know, that's the way he operated, so.
So Bugsy, let me ask you a quick question about Barnett. We had Ron Fuller on a couple episodes ago, and we were asking him to compare Jim Barnett and Sam Muchnick as to, you know, who was the better guy to work for. And one of the things that he said that kind of struck me as interesting about Barnett was that Barnett would say, "I'm going to pay you X amount," and you'd be sitting there thinking, "Wow, that's a really good payoff." And it come time for the actual payoff, and the actual payoff was still good, like sometimes really good, but never quite to what Jim had originally promised you. Is that fairly accurate to say?
No, I can't say that.
Really?
I can't
okay.
say that at all. What he told me I would make, I made.
Okay. Well, that's fair.
Every time. Yeah. I never had a problem there with the money. I always received my money. But you know, like I said, I was always behind Carl, and every time he would say something, I would either shake my head yes, or I go, yep, I agree. You know, that's the thing I never do, because I figured he knew how to handle this guy. I didn't, you know. I mean, it's like I go, yeah, I think Carl's right. Yes, okay.
So let me ask you. One of the parts of the book that I found alternately hilarious and then ultimately very touching, but in a sad way, is the relationship that you had with your friend Lonnie Mayne. And you discuss it in great detail in the book. If you don't mind, again, we don't want to give away too much. Tell the folks a quick Lonnie Mayne story, because there's certainly a plenty of Lonnie Mayne stories in the book.
Oh, there's some stuff.
A great character, would you say?
Oh, a great character. That's not the word for it. Oh, yeah. Lonnie Mayne, I can tell you some stuff that isn't in the book, but I don't want to tell it because it gets drastic, you know, really super drastic.
Well, I tell you what. Why don't you tell
but
the folks?
But I can tell you. Yeah.
Tell the folks a story about the rib that you and Lonnie played on Superstar Billy Graham and his new car.
Well, the car wasn't new. We,
oh, okay.
You know, we're in Hawaii. or in Hawaii. So I had a friend that had a some motorcycle shop, but Lonnie also had a car, but I got a car from him. It was a used car. That's a superstar. Graham was in Hawaii, so he got a used car, you know, just to use. So Lonnie and I, you know, we're talking about what to do, and because Lonnie liked to pull ribs all the time. He was always doing that stuff. He would come up with some drastic stuff. So we decided, you know, what if we take a superstar's car, we fill it with garbage in the front seat, and then we jump on the roof until the roof is in the seat. So that's exactly what we did. We filled the front seat up with garbage. We got on top of the car. We're jumping up and down on it. We drove the roof into the front seat, and we left it for him.
That's a great figure, too.
And it just happened. I was walking out in the garage, you know. You had to get my car to go somewhere. And there was Superstar, and he comes out. He looks at his car, opens up the door. It's full of trash, and the roof is in the front seat. So I felt bad about it, right? I felt bad about it. I said, here, let me help you. So I took the trash out of the front seat, and then I crawled in the front seat, and I took my legs, and I kicked the roof up, you know, just so he could drive it, because otherwise it was not drivable. Yeah, it's a true story, man. True story.
So you were just in right before we were talking, we were talking about Jim Barnett, and I guess, you know, definitely has your respect in the fact that he promised to pay off. He was there, and he delivered on what he said he was going to deliver. I remember, Bugsy, and you were a guest at our first Fan Fest a year and a half ago, and you decided to stick around for dinner, which, we were extremely grateful that you stayed. We were able to ask you questions. But Jeff asked you a question during the dinner, and he said, so who is the one promoter you really did not like and you didn't enjoy working for? And you were very, very vocal about that. And it's really interesting to me because that promoter, if you ask wrestlers, in your era, who's the one promoter that you really don't have respect for? It's the same name every single time. And so I'm going to let you tell that story, but that really stuck with me. But there was one name, obviously, it's somebody based out of California that you weren't very fond of.
Roy Shire. It had to be Roy Shire.
Yes, it was.
Roy Shire. Now, you have to realize, too, that when I was a kid growing up watching wrestling, there were the Shire brothers, and they called themselves the Shire brothers, but it was Roy Shire and Ray Stevens. And at that time, Ray was really young. I think he was only 16, 17 years old. But anyway, and they, in all honesty, they got a lot of heat. I mean, they were, you know, I mean, the fans, now they got almost the heat that the Sheik did. I mean, the fans, there were several times that they tried to kill him. And when I say kill him, I mean, like, really kill him dead. Yeah, I mean, they had a lot of heat. So I go out to work for Roy back in, well, you know, it was a while back, so 1970, I think it was. But Roy, you know, the thing about Roy, now he would pay you well, or reasonably well, you know, but the way he treated people was horrendous. He was, he didn't know how to talk to people. He didn't know how to treat people. And, you know, like walking into the dressing room, see, he would pay by check for every show. You know, if you went to Fresno, you went to Stockton, you went wherever you went, you know, San Francisco. Yeah, so, you know, the next week you got your check. So he would take the check. So, you know, he wouldn't hand them out. You know, he would throw them. Ah, here's your check. You know. You know, that's just one of the things. He was not nice. You know,
he was disrespectful.
Oh, very. You know, to people, and that's just one of the things. That's,
So, Bugsy, one of the other things that I particularly enjoyed about the book, and it's a guy that we've talked about here on the show, is your longtime friendship with Joe LaDuke. So I have a question for you, because it's a question we've asked, and, you know, this is just speculation on our part. Maybe you know the answer. Why did Joe LaDuke, at the height of his being a heel, never get the call to New York? Do you know that?
No, I don't.
I thought he would have been a great opponent for Bob Backlund.
Well, I think he would have been in. I mean, he could have worked with Bruno.
Exactly. Yeah, he was effective. In the role. There's no question about it. So tell us about your friendship with Joe LaDuke and maybe a Joe LaDuke story.
Joe LaDuke and I, we got along very well. When I first came to Florida for a little while, I was at his house, his apartment, for a very short time, up until the time I got my own place and all of that. And we used to travel together, and, he was a nice type of person. He was a nice person. He was a nice person. He was a nice guy. But you could tell if you made him angry that, you'd have a fight on your hands. And we got along. We were on the road together, in the same car together. And, we go drinking together. But, he had a wife and children. And he took care of him. And then again, I saw him up in what's town of Memphis when I was working up there. He was working up there. I think Joe was having, I believe, I don't want to say anything that's not right, but I believe he was having a problem with alcohol and, that type of thing. But, and then he got, when he was in Florida, he got hurt too. He had to have some surgery on his shoulder. And then after that, after he got the surgery and he got rehab, then they had him wrestling there for a while. And then he went to Memphis. I'm not sure. But yeah, Joe was, he could handle himself, so he could work well. And I liked him a lot.
Yeah, another one of these just great kind of monster heels that just drew money in Florida for so many years. It just is such an exciting performer to see. But Bugsy, I really want to talk about, in my opinion, when your career took off in the state of Florida. And you had been around in 1969. You had been a heel aligned with Hans Mortier and the great Malenko. And then you they basically turned on you. You were extremely popular. You were beautiful Brutus, the Big O, Brutus, Sailor Brutus. You came back in 1978 as a heel. You were aligned with Sir Oliver Humperdinck. Really, you were a main event heel, did some great tag team wrestling, but your career, when you turned babyface in early 1980, and I've told you this personally, and I know I've told Jeff this, I was there, and you were, in my opinion, the fans were kind of turning you to some degree because you were so popular, even as a bad guy, you were so popular, and the week that you turned, in my opinion, you became the top babyface in the state, surpassing Dusty Rhodes, who had, for the last 5 or 6 years, been the top guy. The fans took to you just immediately. In my opinion, it was kind of a monumentous occasion from a historical perspective because you took somebody who was this top heel, and all of a sudden, this was the top babyface. How long was this in preparation for? Was this like a spur-of-the-moment decision, or was this something that had been laid out for months?
I think they saw I think they saw the potential. You have to realize, because the way I worked too, because I was I was always somebody that, you know, I would always work toward the match, and I was very active in the ring at all times. You know, like I'd be up and down, be taking bumps, and when I took heat, you know, there's nothing that will draw as well as a vicious heel. And that's the point, see? And I think they saw this, because when I got in the ring, you know, I just really liked to kick ass. And I, you know, and I would stay on, and I would stay on top of the baby face like crazy. And then if they wanted to make a comeback, they had to fight for it. I just wouldn't go, oh, you should hit me once or twice. And no, you got to fight for it. So, you know, it's a point of psychology, actually, because the fans can see that. You know, they can go, oh, this is a bad dude here. You know, he could be hard on anybody. And so then, you know, when it came, because I was working with, they were tagging me with Nikolai Volkov. And obviously he was working as a Russian. And, you know, they could see the potential there, because Nikolai was big and strong, and he looked good. He wasn't a great worker, but so what, you know? So I really believe that they saw the potential, so they kind of laid out a plan, you know, after a few weeks, and then, you know, so I made that switch, and then, you know, the fans really went for it because they, you know, they could see and believe that, you know, I could take on Volkov and that I could handle him if I had to.
Yeah, well, you were about the same size too. So, Jeff, I'm going to break kayfabe right here, and I've got a story to tell both you and Bugsy that I don't think I've ever told on air before. So it's kind of exciting to me. But
does this involve you being a waiter?
No, there's no okay. Restaurant story here whatsoever. Well, actually, let me take that back. There is a restaurant story.
See there, Bugsy, I knew it.
Yeah, you knew.
He knew, but this is
prior to past the mayonnaise.
Again, exactly. So I was a big Bugsy McGraw fan as a kid, and Bugsy, when he was a heel, had a T-shirt, and on the front it said "Why." And on the back, it said, "Why not?" And I was so taken with this T-shirt that my father took me to one of the stores on Miami Beach that the tourists go to. And we actually got a T-shirt made up that said, "Why and why not?" And I would wear it to the arenas. So I wore it every Wednesday night for probably 4 or 5 months. I was washing it, so it wasn't, you know, it wasn't
That's
dirty.
That's good to know.
Yeah, exactly. It's important to know that I had the hygiene at a young age. So I was washing the shirt. So one night we used to go and we used to eat on Lincoln Road and on Alton Road in Miami Beach. And there was a pizza place there called Master's Pizza. I'm wearing the shirt and we're sitting down, and lo and behold, Bugsy McGraw walks into the pizza place. It's probably 6 o'clock, 6:15 at night. Bugsy McGraw walks in, and there's no mistaking Bugsy, 6'5", 6'6", 300 pounds, and I'm wearing the shirt. So I'm like, you know, I'm starstruck, obviously, and I make my way over, and I don't say a word to you, and you see the shirt, and you said, "Look at that shirt, kid. I like it." And I never forgot that, Bugsy.
Well, very good. That's, you know, that's a real compliment. Yeah, but
Bugsy,
I'm sure
you know,
I like it.
You know how to treat an audience, if nothing else, huh?
Well, yeah, you know, I mean, that's how you make your money is the
exactly.
Fans. You got to do, when it comes to certain things, you have to do the right thing. At other times, you got to use psychology when you're in the ring. That's very true. That's absolutely true.
Yeah. So, Bugsy, the next question I want to ask you, getting back again to your Florida days, more specifically towards the end of your Florida days, you
basically write in great detail, and we won't go into great detail, but you kind of felt like the American Dream was kind of doing everything it could to make sure you didn't take that number one babyface spot. Isn't that true?
Oh, absolutely. He knew how to manipulate, and I saw that throughout his career during the time I knew him, which was, for a few years. And I saw how he would, if he thought that he was losing the number one spot, he would make sure that you, all of a sudden, you were working with, with lesser heels and all of that.
Bobby Jaggers.
Bobby Jaggers. I would ask him, I say, why am I working with Jaggers? We got to do this. I said, yeah, but he's not really over that well at all. Why are you having me work with him? Well, the answer was obvious, but he didn't want to say it out loud, So there's a lot of that in the book too. He did the same thing to, when we were in the Carolinas, he did the same thing to the Rock and Roll Express.
Sure.
And that was a true travesty because that hurt the territory. Yeah.
That's a fantastic story too. And we don't want to give away too much of the book because this is something that, Bugsy's heart and soul has been put into this book. And we really want all of our listeners to get a copy. It's a beautiful book. There are some fantastic photos in this book that have never been seen before, a lot of personal photos. And I got to say, there is an amazing quote on the back of the book from some guy. Oh, wait, that's me. Anyways, Ian was kind enough to reach out and say, would you mind giving a quote? And I was like, no, I would absolutely love to. I will tell you, though, everybody listening to our podcast right now, and Jeff and Bugsy were just discussing it, the relationship you had with Dusty Rhodes was very complex, too, to some degree. But yes, you tell a story in there that honestly, when I read it, I think I called Jeff right away. I was calling my other friends. I'm like, you're not going to believe this. There is a Dusty Rhodes story about your relationship with him in this book that has to be read for this alone. this is absolutely just an incredible, incredible story. And Jeff, I know you read it. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I'll tell you, as I read this book, if you're someone who spent any time as a wrestling fan in either the 60s, 70s, or 80s, Bugsy McGraw went to all these different territories. He interacted with so many people that you will see the name and go, oh, my God, he knew this guy, too? Come on. At some point, it's almost like, wow, this is like – it's like going on a geography tour of the world through the eyes of someone who was a wrestler, that was a main event wrestler that drew money where he went. I never knew that Bugsy was in Vancouver working against Gene Kaniski. Great stories there and how he basically was the guy that kept the territory going for a good 2 to 3 year stretch. And I was trying to think, Bugsy, before we get on the air, I'm trying to think, was there anywhere you didn't work, really?
Minnesota, I did one shot. I went into Winnipeg. But at that time,
you didn't do a regular stint with Vern, but pretty much literally every other territory at some point you worked in. And I'm guessing the only guy that maybe you would have wanted to work with that you didn't get a chance to was the guy that you grew up idolizing. And that's Dick the Bruiser. Is that true?
Well, it's in the book.
But I'm saying he was literally probably the only guy of a major significance that you either didn't tag with or work a program with. There were just so many guys, and there's so many different names. So as a
Bruiser. The Bruiser. I mean, when I was a kid, that was my idol. I thought a lot of him. And I'll tell a little story. There's a few of them in there with me and the Bruiser and what happened in the dressing room one time and what happened at the airport one time, but I was like, this is when I was roughly, I was in college. I was 18 years old and I'm driving down the street at home in Indianapolis, and I look in my rearview mirror, and there's Dick the Bruiser in his car. Now I'm 18. Now I've been, I've been lifting weights, and I'm young, I'm dumb, and I'm full of cum, that old expression. So I figured, been Dick there. The Bruiser. Yeah. I think we all have,
Yep.
And so I look in the rearview mirror, and there he is right behind me, Dick the Bruiser. So I thought, you know what? I think I'll stop the car and I'll kick his ass. Well, so he tries to pass me. I won't let him. And I slow down again. Tries to pass again. I won't let him. And so he finally passes me. Thank God I didn't stop, because he would have kicked my ass from here to next week. I mean, he was a tough, he was truly tough. You know what I mean? I mean, this is a guy that, he got kicked out of college, out of four colleges each time for fighting. And then, he played professional football, and he was all pro. This was a truly tough guy. And I was only 18, and I thought I was tough, oh boy, I'm something. But thank the Lord he didn't stop, because he would have kicked my butt bad, But anyway, that's just one of the things in the book. But there's others.
You definitely don't cheat the reader. That's for sure. So let me ask you a question. As you talked about how what a scary guy Dick the Bruiser was back in the day, you mentioned in a few different areas where, dare I say, maybe outside the ring, there was a situation or two that you were involved with. So when you look back on your career, I've asked other people this question. I'm curious as to what your thoughts are. If you could think of one guy, you're in a bar and 10 guys are coming looking to start a negative situation with you, and you can have one guy that's been part of your past career standing next to you in that bar, who would it be?
Oh, well, this kind of depends. There's a couple of that came right to my mind right away. One would be Joe LeDuc. Another would be Bruno Sammartino. Another might be Cox, Killer Cox.
Interesting. Okay.
That's about the three I can think of. Off the top of my head, yeah.
Sure, good choices all. Would you agree, Barry?
But there's a few that I wouldn't want to have on my side that so much either.
Guys that maybe thought they were tough guys that maybe weren't?
Oh, yeah, and it's in the book, too.
It is in the book.
That's what they call a tease.
tease, please tease. Oh yeah.
Absolutely. So some of the guys that you were in Florida with, and I always go back, because obviously this was the formative years for me, but when you were there, Buddy Rogers was the booker and actually was putting himself in main events. And generally, these main events with Buddy were like 8-man tag team matches, and Buddy would tag himself in, do a drop kick or two, and then get the pinfall, and that was basically the extent of it. And granted, he was in his late 50s, but there was a lot of criticism on his booking style. And I remember when I was speaking with Jerry Briscoe about it, he told me this story, and I believe the story went something like, Eddie had hired Buddy to be the booker, but under the condition that Buddy wasn't to work any matches, wasn't to put himself in the ring. And I guess Eddie had stepped away for a little bit, and when Eddie came back and saw that Buddy was pushing himself in the main events, he fired him. Does that sound accurate?
Yeah, that's very true, because he told Rogers, you're the book, you're not the work. We all knew that. Everybody in the territory knew that. Rogers is the book, he's not the work. And, you know, but he had an ego that was, you know, well, let's just say huge, because it was. And I had been told by a few people, Bruno told me, Penny Miller told me, and other people told me, said, one thing you can't do, you can't trust Rogers. And, you know, so I was always aware of that. And one time he tried to set me up and I blocked him. So, but yeah. And then you'll have to read in the book, you know, what happened when Sonny King, actually it was a Sonny King. He got Rogers to work again. It was Sonny King. You'll have to read that in the book. It's something.
There's also some great stories about in the book, and I won't reveal too much, but about Sonny King outside the ring, dare I say, Bugsy. Would that be correct?
Oh, Sonny King, I mean, I like Sonny King a lot, you know, and I used to travel with him, and he was, you know, he could be a hothead, you know what I mean? And he carried a gun, you know, like a big, you know, 45. And he wasn't afraid to take it out of the glove compartment at all. Believe me. And there's some stories in there about that too, you know?
Well, I was primarily referring to some of the stories you told about Sonny's experiences with some of the ladies in the area of Florida that you detailed as you know, and you go into detail about Sonny's abilities as a ladies' man, dare I say.
Well, you know, you know how usually, you know, the racial thing, you know, that's way overplayed, you know. So he was a man. Well, he was a black man, but mainly I saw him as a man, but Sonny King, he had, you know, just actual facts here I'm talking about. He had more white women than anybody else.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Well, let's cut to the chase. He was a bit of a cock. Is that what you're saying?
But that's in the book, too.
Exactly. And that's just another part of the reason why it's such a great read for any wrestling fan. Anybody that has any sort of history with wrestling in the 60s, 70s, or 80s are just going to really love this book, Brute Power, again by Ian Douglas and Bugsy McGraw.
Yeah, it absolutely is such a fantastic book. And I'm going to tell you one of the secrets of why I think it's so great too. And I think that Jeff, you understanding this, and I think in Bugsy, you also, you'll both agree, Bugsy kept the scrapbooks of his career. So after you've got a career that's lasted some 40 to, you know, 40 something years, you're not going to remember every detail. It's just impossible. But Bugsy kept these really detailed scrapbooks of his career and was able to go back and reference it. And in turn, he's put out, and again, this is one of the best wrestling books you will ever read. If you want to read an honest portrayal of what it was like in the territory days, and really one man's life, this is the book for you. I put it right up there with J.J. Dillon's book. And the reason J.J. Dillon's book was so successful, he kept these journals. And there's a pattern now that if you're keeping journals, and you're really going to know exactly what was going on in your career. So let's talk about the Kickstarter campaign a little bit. So because this is a self-published book, they have gotten together, Ian and Bugsy, and they're launching a Kickstarter campaign. And I just want to talk about that for a couple of minutes. If you make a donation, and there's several different tiers and levels, you receive something as well. So for $10, you get a personalized thank you postcard, and the postcard is the actual cover of the book. And Bugsy will autograph it, personalized to you. It's only 10 bucks, let me tell you. And Bugsy, I've got about 30 of your autographs, and you're one of the best autographs in professional wrestling. It is large, it is clear, and you always write something cool on it, which is usually USA or something similar. You have one of the best autographs ever. For $19, you can get a copy of the autobiography. For $29, an autographed copy of the Brew Power autobiography, autographed to you, which is fantastic. For $40, an autographed book and a signed photo. For $44, you can get two autographed copies of Brew Power. So you get one for yourself, and then you give one to your best friend. We all need a best friend. This makes perfect sense. $75, two autographed copies, and your name is on the thank you page of the book. So think about that for a minute. You're actually helping this book to get published, and your name goes in the thank you notes. It's only $75.
And that Barry, we know people in our group that really appreciate a nice thank you and a mention, don't we?
Boy, Jeff, at this stage, I'm going to imagine this is going to sell out, because our group, they're all about shout outs and getting their names in print. So, yes, absolutely. This is where I come into play, Jeff. And Ian Douglas said, you're going to want this one, and he's 100% right. For $150, you get an autographed copy of Brute Power, and you get a hardbound copy of Bugsy's three personal career scrapbooks. Boom, drop the mic. More than 500 photos, programs, and newspaper clippings from his entire career. This is stuff that has never been seen before. I told Ian, I said, well, I know what I'm going to get myself. That's exactly what I'm getting myself. And lastly, if you're the big spender, if you are the one who wants this experience for $1,200, which is actually a bargain. I know some of these guys have done this for like $2,000 and $3,000. No, sir. Bugsy McGraw, Bugsy Power, Brute, USA, meet Bugsy McGraw for dinner, only $1,200. You choose the restaurant. Bugsy will meet you there for dinner. Bugsy, I believe this has to be in the state of Florida, somewhere near Daytona, if I'm correct.
Absolutely correct. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And I will say, Bugsy likes all kinds of food, which I'm aware of. Bugsy would love to go out to dinner with you. It's $1,200. You can bring a friend if you want, obviously. It's a bargain. And I can tell you, I've spent time with Bugsy. Jeff has spent time with Bugsy. You've heard the stories today. The man is a storyteller, and he's got literally 50 years of stories to tell people. So you can go to our Facebook page, which is Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry. We will have the Kickstarter link up there. We'll have all of these different levels that you can contribute. This is something you are going to want to be a part of. This is history in the making. I'm just proud to be associated with this. And Jeff, again, you read this book. I forwarded it to you. You just knocked this thing out like I did.
Yes, it's I can't even say and I'm going to tell you something, as much as I enjoy Bugsy, if I thought it was a good book, I'd say it's a good book. This is a great book. And Bugsy, we are so appreciative of you coming on the show with us today and talking just in very minor detail about some of the great stories that are in the book. I can't encourage you enough. I will say I'm going to throw a challenge out right now, Barry. I'm going to challenge our man BVK, Bobby Van Kevlar. Bobby, I'm guessing you might want a dinner with Bugsy pretty near future. I think it's something you need to set up, my man. I'm also saddened to say that apparently, since it's only going to be in the Daytona area, Barry, it looks like that Bugsy will not be traveling to Shima with the boys. That's a private joke, Barry. Bugsy. So anyway, we want to thank again Bugsy so much for joining us here on Breaking Kayfabe with Bowdrin and Barry and telling us about his new project, his new book, Brute Power. With Ian Douglas and Bugsy McGraw. Bugsy, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, before you leave us too, Bugsy, will you come back again and be a guest with us? We really enjoyed this.
Oh, absolutely. Just before I go, though, I would like to thank you and the fact that you enjoyed the book. I would like to thank my co-writer too, because he did a great job. I mean, he helped me write this book, and it was excellent because I can tell it's excellent because the way you enjoyed it.
You
and One other thing I want to add in there that the fans can find really exciting too when they read the book, because I don't know if other wrestlers have ever written about, but you know, I was involved in a few riots, and they can be exciting. So I mean, when they read the book, they can see what happens in a full scale riot, and what happens, you know.
Absolutely.
That's one of the things that they can find, you know, that they can find interesting and exciting. So, but yes, I would like to return to your show again. It's been a pleasure, yeah, to talk with you. I really appreciate the fact that you enjoyed the book, and I hope to see you soon. Yeah, the both of you, praise God.
Okay, well, thank you, Bugsy. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Right. Have a great day. We'll be in touch. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, bye-bye.
Good stuff, Barry. I think you'll agree. I thought that was a pretty fascinating interview.
He's so much fun. You know, to me, you got a guy that, you know, he's been around wrestling for, you know, ever since he was a kid watching it. And I love the fact that somebody's a fan and then gets in the business. But what a great career he had. And just so much fun to have. I truly, and I say this, I truly hope that we can get him back with us again.
Yeah, he's good stuff, and I just can't get enough of those stories. You know what I really like? I like hearing stories about places that you don't always hear from, you know, and hearing stories about Joe LaDuke and Lonnie Mayne. That's the kind of stuff that I know that Kevin Orcutt was out there listening to the Lonnie Mayne stuff and just, you know, Kevin, I got to tell you, you got to buy this book just for the Lonnie Mayne stories. I will say that. So now, Barry, it is time for us to go to the top five list. We are talking about our top five TV show theme songs. And I hope you folks are strapped in, because this was not an easy list to come up with. And as I say on more than one occasion, I'm sure after we're done, somebody out there is going to go, "You guys are fucking idiots. I can't believe you forgot this song." So yeah, we expect that. We are fucking idiots. And so just, you know,
the truth. Yeah.
Yeah, boy.
Exactly.
So Barry, why don't you tell us your number five? And by the way, this is not the best TV theme song. These are all personal favorites. So just kind of get the fuck over yourselves. So anyway, go ahead. Barry, number five.
Absolutely, Jeff. So my number five is going to be the theme song to American Horror Story. So this falls into, I actually have two on my list that are instrumentals with no vocals. American Horror Story, and Jeff, I don't believe you've ever watched it. So what's cool about it, and I believe it's been seven seasons thus far, seven or eight, though I absolutely fucking hated last season. It was the worst piece of shit. And to me, the show may have jumped the shark. That being said, the theme song is tremendous. And the theme song, what they do is it's the same theme every year. They just tweak it a little bit. And my personal favorite was the season for Freaks, where it was based off of carnival and sideshows and things like that. And they kind of tweaked it, and they made it kind of a country fair or carnival aspect to it. So I love the fact that it's, while it's, the bones are the same, there's little nuances that change every year with the theme song. And it's a favorite. I actually have as one of my ringtones on my phone the American Horror Story Freaks theme. What's kind of cool about this as well is two guys are actually the composers. It's a guy named Charlie Clouser and Cesar Davila Irizarry. And this guy, Cesar Irizarry, apparently wrote this 20 years ago in 1998 and wasn't even aiming for horror. He basically did it, and he did it, I guess he was taking some music history course in his sophomore year at the University of Puerto Rico, and he wanted to experiment with, like, stretching, like, mundane noises in his mother's house. And the first loud noise you hear in the theme, and there is, like, this abrupt sound at the beginning of the theme. In fact, it's the sound of metal hangers hitting a tile floor. So I really like that. To me, it's kind of cool that this song was discovered some, you know, 10 years after it was actually created. So for me, number five, American Horror Story.
Okay, my number five, and I can promise you folks that I won't have near the detail that Barry will have.
I have no life.
My number five.
I have no fucking life.
Let me just say, as I sat there and I looked at the movie, yeah, and you know, like I, like Barry said, I came up with like 12 or 15 shows that I could have put on here. And I started thinking, what was some that to me personally were part of growing up or part of me being a TV viewer? And I couldn't help noticing that most of them are older. There's no recent stuff. I got to be honest with you. Now, that being said, there's a lot of really good, you know, CSI. Seinfeld had a great opening riff. You know, so, but most of my songs are stuff from when I was growing up. And I will mention some others towards the end of the list that were, dare I say, honorable mentions. Well, number five, Love, Exciting and New. Yes, it's Jack Jones singing the theme to The Love Boat, Barry. And when I told Barry what my choice was, he goes, "Hey, Jack Jones, I remember that song." Barry, tell us what you remember about the Love Boat theme song.
Well, Jeff, so there's probably, I don't know, maybe there's 20 theme songs. Again, I have no life. Maybe there are 20 theme songs that I would know every single word to, and The Love Boat falls right into it. And The Love Boat was on seemingly forever. I don't know how long it ran on television, but certainly through most of my youth, into my teenage years, into my young adulthood, and I always watched The Love Boat. There were some episodes that were just brutally terrible, but quite frankly, that song never got old. And I will tell you, I was traveling across the – I don't know why the fuck I remember this. I was traveling across the country. I went from Miami to Los Angeles, and I was in some shitty $20 a night motel. This is 1985 in Mobile, Alabama. And I've got a bucket of KFC next to me, and I'm watching television, and the only thing that would come on TV, this was a Saturday night, was The Love Boat. And I sat there with my bucket of KFC in a fucking shithole of a motel in Mobile, Alabama, Jeff, and I sang the goddamn Love Boat theme song.
There is nothing like being in Mobile, Alabama, eating some chicken and listening to The Love Boat. What's your number four, Barry?
My number four, so this is a song that is, it's a little touching to me because it's not a, it's Cheers. It's a theme song to Cheers where everybody knows your name. And Jeff, it was, I guess I was kind of surprised when we talked about Cheers at one point, which is months ago, that you never really watched a lot of Cheers. Well, I've seen every episode of Cheers probably five times, maybe even more. And I have two shows on Netflix that I go to, Cheers being one of the, and I'm talking about shows that I've seen a million times, old TV shows, Cheers is one of those. I can put on any episode of Cheers, and, you know, for me, it's like going back 30 years. But Cheers was written by a guy named Gary Portnoy and a friend of his, Judy Hart Angelo. Portnoy was a New York songwriter who also performed the song, and he was best known for penning the theme song to Punky Brewster. Do you remember that one, Jeff? The Punky Brewster theme song? Me neither. I have
who
no
can forget?
Idea.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I have no idea. But he was apparently a real songwriter. He had written songs for people like Air Supply, Dolly Parton, and some others. The song received an Emmy Award nomination in 1983 for Outstanding Achievement in Music and Lyrics. In 2011, a readers' poll in Rolling Stone magazine said that Where Everybody Knows Your Name was voted the best television theme of all time. In 2013, the editors of TV Guide magazine named Where Everybody Knows Your Name the greatest TV theme of all time. Jeff, it's my number four.
My number four comes from the late 70s, early 80s. We are talking about Baby, If You've Ever Wondered Whatever Became of Me. I'm Living on the Air. Barry, where's he at?
WKRP.
In Cincinnati. Yes, indeed. The song apparently was written by the series creator Hugh Wilson, was performed by Steve Carlisle. And this was one, yeah, first of all, the KRP show. And you know, the funny thing is this is really the one song that remains from that show because of music copyright issues. All the stuff that they played in the original airing of the show, of course, that shit never comes out. I think they were still, I mean, literally within the last couple of months, we're still negotiating to put out DVD sets with the original music in there, which I would just love to see. I remember some people had bootleg copies, dare I say, I won't mention their name. Somebody we both know though, Barry. And, but this is the one song that sticks out from that show, you know, been living up and down the dial, and yeah, it's just as Gary Sandy came walking into the studio to take over the programming of WKRP in Cincinnati, Barry. So what's your number three?
My number three, just sit right back and you hear a tale of a fateful trip. It's Gilligan's Island. So, you know, a couple of mine definitely go, actually most of mine kind of go back, but Gilligan's Island to me was, you know, it's such a ridiculous premise for a television show. Yet as a kid, I, you know, every day I would come home from school and it was on at like 4:30, and I would definitely make sure. And I remember having a conversation with an adult, and I was probably 13, 14, or 15 years old, and they said, what's your favorite TV show? And I said, without hesitation, it's Gilligan's Island. And they said, really? I said, it doesn't bother you that they wear the same clothes every day, and the clothes are sparkling clean, and they've been stuck on an island? The show makes no sense. The show made no sense, but that fucking theme song, I can sing it frontwards, backwards, and sideways. It was actually created by Sherwood Schwartz, and a guy named George Weil. It's called The Balligan of Gilligan's Island. And Sherwood Schwartz was also the creator. Did I say The Balligan?
I think you meant The Ballad of.
Yeah, so I'm going to start combining words now so we don't have an eight-hour show, but The Ballad of Gilligan's Island. And Sherwood Schwartz was also the creator and producer of the show. So it was kind of interesting. If you notice, if you've ever watched Gilligan's Island, and I guess watched it deeply like I have, again, I have no life, there was a different version from year one versus seasons two and three. And apparently in the first version, they say the rest in referring to the professor and Marianne. And they were apparently called, they were considered second billed co-stars. So they referred to them as the rest. Apparently Bob Denver did not like that. He personally asked studio executives to add the professor and Marianne to the song. They refused, and he said, well, that's fine then. If you're going to refuse, then take me out of it also. The studio then relented, and then, of course, it became the Professor Ran Marianne here on Gilligan's. Exactly. So that is my number three. I absolutely just love the song.
I'm just sitting here wondering, as you and I have both hummed, sang some attempt at that on these songs, is there some guy right now driving in his car laughing, going, holy fuck, who told these guys they could sing? Well, the answer is nobody. Nobody, yes.
There you go.
My number three, Barry, comes from a show. The lyrics were written by Don Nickel and Joe Rapasso. Barry, I know you will recall from our youth, come and knock on our door, come and knock on our door. We've been waiting for you, we've been waiting for you. The theme to Three's Company and Suzanne Summers lying out by that pool, getting the water thrown on her back. Three's Company theme songs, Barry.
Yeah, it's a great song, too. And again, this is one that, you know, if you grew up in our era, and I think the difference also, like, you know, I was talking with my son, which I do frequently because we live in the same house.
And that's nice.
Son, yeah, it's a good idea. But I was talking with him, and, you know, he doesn't watch any television. And I said, what was the last thing you watched on TV? He goes, I watched a couple of the matches of the NXT TakeOver with you a few weeks back. I said, but what about, okay, so take out professional wrestling. What do you, and he goes, I don't watch anything on TV. And he's on his electronics, so he's watching something on YouTube. You know, he's a 17-year-old boy. I'm sure he's watching other things.
Wait a minute.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Don't let him get around Jeff Zinger. That's all I'll say.
Oh, that's for sure, right? But, yeah, so he doesn't watch TV. I think the difference for you and I was we didn't have, you know, we could go outside and play. But if we were in the house, we were watching TV or reading a book. We didn't have electronics. These did not exist. So when you have shows like Three's Company, Gilligan's Island, you know, you learn these songs because you saw these shows week in and week out. So certainly, Jeff, I know that. And so let me ask you a question. And this is, I'm not going to give you an F, Mary, kill on this one. We had a great response, by the way, with Christy Canyon and Hyapatia Lee. And I got to admit, you know, Hyapatia Lee, I'm definitely getting way off topic now, but Hypatia Lee is my type. But I got to admit, the assets of Christy Canyon really, really are impressive. That's a different level.
I quoted the Bob Seger song last week. She had good points of her own, sitting way up high. And I think that was one of Christy's best attributes, dare I say.
Oh, Helen Keller could tell you that's her best attribute. The photo that you put up is just a stunning photo, the photo you put up of her. But I was going to say, so Suzanne Summers or Jenny Lee Harrison?
Oh, Suzanne Summers. No question about it. Suzanne Summers.
I was a big Jenny Lee Harrison fan.
I was not. I was much more of a Suzanne Summers. It's, you know, it's like asking, you know, at the end of Charlie's Angels, which ones did you like? Cheryl Ladd, Farrah Fawcett, Tanya, what's her name?
Tanya Roberts.
Tanya Roberts, you know. So, but I was always more of a Suzanne Summers. Joyce DeWitt, very cute, very perky. But, you know, Suzanne Summers was the bombshell. Barry, number two.
Number two. Jeff, that is Eight Simple Notes. And those Eight Simple Notes, Jeff, have permeated American pop culture for the last 50-plus years. Jeff, it is one of our favorite TV shows. It is also the other TV show that I will go to Netflix if I have nothing else to watch. It's midnight. I'm getting ready to go to bed. I'll turn the Twilight Zone on, and I'll always usually go to one of like five or six episodes that I absolutely love. The Twilight Zone, again, this is my second instrumental. There are no words. This is also one of my ringtones on my phone. It is, everybody knows, my daughter, who has never seen an episode of the Twilight Zone, knows the theme to the Twilight Zone, because that's how much it's actually permeated pop culture over the last 50 plus years. So the original theme to The Twilight Zone was done by a composer, Bernard Herrmann. And Jeff, you would be very familiar with Bernard Herrmann.
Yeah, no, he's very well known. I've heard of that name before.
Absolutely. He worked with Hitchcock a lot. He did North by Northwest, Psycho, also did Cape Fear and Taxi Driver. But apparently they decided that the original theme was a bit of a downer. And that was the reason that they gave, that it was a bit of a downer. So they went to a French guy named Marius Constant, and he wrote the really more well-known theme song that we know as far as the Twilight Zone. But apparently, it wasn't that it was just a downer. Apparently, this was a way to save money. Constant was French, and the network didn't have to pay union fees for music that was created outside of the United States. So a little manipulation there. But at the same time, if you've ever heard the season one, it's moody. I like it, actually, because it's moody, but it's totally different than what we are used to with season two and then going forward. So for me, it is Twilight Zone is number two.
And by the way, as I posted on the message board, I believe the Sci-Fi Channel, even though it's available on Netflix, the Sci-Fi Channel is running as they do pretty much every New Year's Day, a marathon on the Sci-Fi Network. And I think they probably have like somewhere in the neighborhood of about 50 to 60 episodes over the course of 2 days running back to back to back. And I think on the thread that I posted on our board, you actually have the viewing schedule. So, of course, one of the all-time classic shows, no question about it. Barry, my number two. Get ready, Mom. I'm sorry for what I'm about to do. My number two starts off, Barry, with this. Green Acres is the place to be. Farm living is the life for me. Land spreading out so far and wide. Keep Manhattan, just give me that countryside, dude. It's the Green Acres theme song, originally written, Barry, by Vic Mizzy.
Who?
No,
who? Vic Mizzy, the great Vic Mizzy.
Mizzy. Oh, yeah. I have all of his work, all of Vic Mizzy's work.
Well, you know his one song for sure. It's the theme to Green Acres.
Yeah.
The great Eddie Albert.
Wasn't Eddie Albert like 100 years old when he finally passed away?
Fresh air. Yes, Lou was sending me a note. He had a very long life. He actually had a brush with greatness. When I first started working at the courthouse, Eddie Albert came to my courthouse to film a TV movie about the trial of Roswell Gilbert, Roswell Gilbert was a man in the mid-80s in Broward County who was charged with murder, who had assisted his wife in her suicide. And that was my brush with Eddie Gilbert back some 30-something years ago, Barry.
Yeah, he was – I mean, he's also in that the movie that we love.
I said Eddie Gilbert. Thanks, Lou.
Did you say Eddie Gilbert? Eddie, yeah. Roswell Gilbert and Eddie Albert. Yes.
The Longest Yard. Eddie Albert. Thank you.
Eddie Albert in The Longest Yard, which has been on cable. I've been watching that lately. But he was a great actor. This is such a good movie. This is such a good TV. It's a good movie, but it's such a good TV show. And it's on – is it on Nickelodeon? I know it's on some cable channel, Mr. Haney. The Pig. What a great theme song, though. I absolutely – and Vic Mizzy, what a body of work on him, you know?
All he needed was this one song to be put over with me. So, yeah, that there's so many great characters. Mr. Haney, played by Pat Buttram, is just such a classic show. Barry, it is time for you to reveal to the good folks. And by the way, I know Travis Raines right now is going, Eddie Gilbert, I love when Baldwin fucks up. Give us your number one all-time favorite TV theme song.
Those boys got shitty memories, too. So my number one, and Jeff, before that, of course, I've got to give you the runners-up because my list 50 times. The aforementioned Curb Your Enthusiasm. Dun, 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 dun.
Good song.
Jeff, yep, you mentioned Seinfeld. I mean, come on. Everybody knows the bass line of Seinfeld. The Flintstones. Meet the Flintstones. I don't give a shit if it's a cartoon or not. That's a great fucking theme song. Sticking with that, The Simpsons. Who doesn't know The Simpsons? Composer Danny Elfman from Oingo Boingo getting billions of dollars every time that song is played. Mission Impossible, Rawhide, Hawaii Five-O, Barney Miller, The Brady Bunch, Sanford and Son, The Monsters, Happy Days, Laverne and Shirley. And one of my personal favorites that made the list, and then I bumped it right off, so it's probably number six, Dexter.
Okay.
And on that note, you're speechless. I get it. My number one of all time, The Beverly Hillbillies. So I was going to sing it, and I said, yeah, you know what? I don't want to sing it. But The Beverly Hillbillies is one of these songs that, you know, if I ever do karaoke, and I have done karaoke, and I'm not a great singer. I'm not even a good singer. I'm not even a bad singer. I'm worse than that. But The Ballad of Jed Clampett is one of two songs that I always look to perform because, A, I know every word, and, B, a bad singer can actually get away with this song. So written and composed by a gentleman named Paul Hennig, not to be confused with Kurt or Larry Hennig, because there's an N at the end. It's Lester Flatt and Earl Scruggs on guitar and banjo. And these were two really of the most famous bluegrass musicians of all time. So CBS didn't fuck around with this. They went out and they got two heavy hitters for this. The song spent 20 weeks on the Billboard Country Singles charts, reaching a peak of number one for 3 weeks in a row and reached number 44 on the Billboard Hot 100 in 1962. Have you ever heard of a guy named Bela Fleck?
I have not.
So he's a banjo guy, but I believe he plays the guitar as well. It's Bela Fleck and the Flecktones. But he's a banjo virtuoso, and he actually plays this song, this ballad, in concert. So for me, The Beverly Hillbillies, and this is much like Gilligan's Island, that, you know, I would sit there, and I think it was a 1-2 punch. It would be Gilligan's Island and then Beverly Hillbillies, and I knew all these theme songs. So I can still sing this if I ever, you know, have a few adult beverages and there's karaoke and this song is available. I may just surprise you and start to sing, Jeff.
Oh, well, we don't want that. But let me tell you a little story about a man named Jed, poor mountaineer, barely kept his family fed.
One day he was shooting at some food, and up from the ground came a bubbling crude.
That is black gold, Texas tea. So my number one, before I get to it, I will reveal my honorable mentions. There were a few that you mentioned, Barry, the Brady Bunch. The Flintstones were on my list. Here's one we forgot, Barry. How about MASH? Suicide is Painless. That was a huge deal. You mentioned Laverne and Shirley. We raise a glass to the memory of Penny Marshall. So here, Barry, we are probably the only show in the podcast world that raises a glass to Raul Mata and Penny Marshall on the same show. Boom! I lay down a challenge for the rest of the podcast. Rawhide, as performed by Jake and Elwood, the Blues Brothers, the theme to Rawhide, Rowdy Yates. A couple more that we did not mention. The theme to Welcome Back, Cotter by John Sebastian. That was a huge hit. Yeah. And, of course, the theme show, the theme song to the Monkees. Hey, hey, we're the Monkees. So who can forget that one? But, Barry, my number one was written by Jay Livingston, and it goes like this, Barry.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
A horse is a horse, of course, and no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. Ed. The theme song to Mr. Ed. What a fucking great song that was. And boy, that is like, bird is the word. When you get the theme song to Mr. fucking Ed in your head, you might as well just finish up the day because you're going to be humming that bad boy. And right now, Travis Raines or who else, one of the other guys, is sitting there going, horse, of course, Mr. Ed. They're fucking singing the song, Barry. I just know it. And before we go on, that is my number one choice, Barry. Before we get your thoughts on Mr. Ed, I am at this point for the first time in our show. Lou Kippelman has a choice that we did not mention. Lou, come on the air and tell us what your choice is, my man.
Oh, why, thank you. Hello, everybody.
Hello, America.
Yes. Ahoy to everybody on the brothership. Let's see. I tell you, you mentioned Sanford and Son, and I think that's Aces. That's Quincy Jones. The name of the composition is The Street Beater. Quincy Jones trivia. Another one of his songs was a theme for a Goodson Todman game show in 1974-75, and it's called Chump Change. The name of the game show is Now You See It.
Lou is filled with trivia, folks. That's why we got him working with our show. But what was the one that you just texted me?
Oh, yeah. Which one are we looking at here?
Petticoat.
Oh, Petticoat.
Junction.
Yeah, absolutely. That was, I mentioned it was the Paul Henning hat trick, being that he was the creator of Beverly Hillbillies, Petticoat Junction, and Green Acres. So,
there you go. He did all the countryfied shows.
So, for the redneck completists out there.
Petticoat. Yes, absolutely.
Who's not, though, when you stop and think about it?
Exactly.
Which of us really aren't redneck completists, right?
So we appreciate Luke coming on, expressing his views. Before we go,
Sweet
Barry,
Lou.
I got a couple of, I got a very quick story that I got to tell you before we go about the lovely Mrs. Bowdron and something she told me last night. So we're getting ready to go to bed, and the wife has told me that she's put out, you got the little sugar ants or the crazy ants in your kitchen or whatever. Well, for whatever reason, we had a little crazy ant situation going on our bathroom counter. So the wife informs me that she gets like the little liquid stuff where they take it and they bring it back to the hive or whatever. So my wife, as I'm getting to bed, says, oh, by the way, I put your little face cloth there in the middle of the counter. I didn't put it in the corner where it usually is because that's where I put the poison. And I said, oh, really? Okay, yeah. She goes, yeah, that's where I put, and she uses this phrase, Barry, that's where I put the nectar of death.
Ooh.
And it was at that point I asked myself, who is this woman that I'm married to that uses the expression nectar of death? Barry, who am I married to? Who is this woman that I've been with for 20 years? And she's using terms like nectar of death.
It's a woman who hates Neil Young and Steely Dan is who it is.
And we have verified that, I can tell you, because Steely Dan came on last night. We were driving in the car and she goes, you know, I hate this. Turn it. I will say that my wife says that the one song by Steely Dan she does appreciate is, in fact, one of my favorites, Dirty Work. Okay, Barry. Now, as we're closing up, I want to just say one last thing before we go. I had a chance, and I want to give a shout out to my boy Greg Good, who's the one that really turned me onto this. That it was something that I would have gotten to eventually, but when we were coming back from the recent convention a couple months back in Tampa, I was riding back with Greg, And, you know, we were listening to some different music, and Greg goes, oh, I got something I bet you like. And he had a chance to pop in the late David Bowie's CD, Black Star. And yeah, I listened to a couple songs. Well, today I was sitting at work, didn't have much to do, and I listened beginning to end to Black Star. Barry, what an incredible, incredible piece of work that David Bowie left us with literally right before he died. An amazing, amazing collection. And the CD ends with the song, I Can't Give Everything Away. And, you know, someone said it was like Bowie saying that I'm a magician who can't show you all of my tricks. Barry, just an amazing, amazing work that I can't recommend enough.
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't heard it, but based off of this recommendation, and Greg Good, I mean, let's be honest, Greg Good knows his music, so I think I will be checking it out.
Absolutely. I will encourage you folks to follow me on Twitter at Baldrin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard podcast industry. In the production booth tonight, as Barry and I have stated, sweet Lou Kippelman. Thanks for joining us, Lou, and until next week, folks. I hope you guys have a happy holiday, and I hope you get a laugh out of our singing tonight. Good Lord, Mary, we were terrible. Have a good one.